loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Republicans on Capitol Hill are scrambling to put together a bill that would reunite migrant children with their parents, as eight governors announced that they will not allow their state National Guard units to deploy to the border. Professional organizations warn of the long-term effects of separation on the children, and the policy galvanizes Democrats. Next, military officers of the United Arab Emirates are running a system of at least 18 secret prisons in Yemen. Former detainees from those prisons say the Emiratis raped and tortured them in a pattern of sexual violence and abuse that was carried out all across the country. Then, National Public Radio seems to have a problem with government-related media outlets. This morning, the network ran yet another ridiculous hit piece going after RT and Sputnik. And then former CIA Director John Brennan told MSNBC yesterday that he was alarmed by reports that the Trump administration has carried out five times the number of drone attacks around the world than the Obama administration carried out. Brennan claimed that the Obama drone program killed almost no civilians at all, and that Trump must be killing civilians due to the sheer volume of the bombings. And finally, violence continued across Nicaragua today, a day after the collapse of talks between President Daniel Ortega and the opposition. More than 180 people have been killed in violence that started when the IMF demanded that the government cut pensions and impose economic austerity. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
In breaking news, faced with a growing crescendo of nationwide and international opposition to his policy that separated parents from their children at the U.S.-Mexican border, President Donald Trump just signed an executive order reversing this policy of separating immigrant families at the border. He said, quote, "We are going to have a lot of happy people," close quote, and quote, "We want to keep families together," close quote. His so-called zero-tolerance policy for immigration, however, will continue, he says. The executive order seems to have been written with a deliberate ambivalence, leaving open the question of whether or not children will still be separated from their parents. Let's listen carefully to the language. Quote, "The administration will initiate proceedings to enforce this and other criminal provisions until and unless Congress dictates otherwise," but adds, quote, "It is also the policy of this administration to maintain family unity, including by detaining alien families together where appropriate and consistent with law and available resources," close quote. So what does this mean? What does it mean that this policy will be applied, quote, "where appropriate and consistent with law and available resources"? Clearly, the Trump administration is reacting to the massive political opposition that gained momentum in recent days. Without it, there would have been no adjustment in this policy. So perhaps the big question is whether the grassroots opposition to Trump's immigration policy will be satisfied with the executive order, or will it instead intensify in the mobilization and street protests in the coming days and weeks? It's an improvement for immigrant families to be able to remain together even while in custody, but the imperative need is for these families and these individuals to receive justice, real justice, in their applications for asylum. Reacting to reports that Trump would sign this executive order, we spoke earlier today with immigrant rights advocate Brent Wilkes about the issue. Let's take a listen.
Brent, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
Brent, can you start by telling our listeners what the difference is between this Trump administration policy to separate children from their families and what the Obama administration was doing?
Well, I think the big difference is that under the Obama administration, when people were applying for asylum, they went ahead and gave them a court date, but would release them to be able to return back for the court date to hear their asylum claim as long as they had a credible case. And for folks who didn't have a credible case or who weren't claiming asylum, they may be detained until they could undergo a hearing, but they were detained together, not separately, so they wouldn't separate the children from their parents. Now, there still were children in facilities, in detention facilities, but these were individuals who were the unaccompanied minors, people who were actually coming to the border without their parents. And in those cases, of course, they were being housed in these facilities, but but they tended to be older children. What's happening with the Trump administration now is he's made it his policy, regardless of whether people are applying for asylum or whether they're not applying for asylum or whether they have a credible case, he was taking their children away and putting them in detention, putting the children in these facilities. And that was what's caused this uproar and all this trauma, because, of course, tearing kids away from the parents is a really big deal.
Brent Wilkes is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. John, this has become a world story, a worldwide story.
Without any doubt, the international press is jumping up and down over this story. The United Nations has issued two statements. The Canadians, the British, the Chinese, everybody's talking about this around the world. And then just today, Governor Cuomo in New York filed what he's calling a multi-agency lawsuit against the Trump administration, saying that that the goal of the suit is to protect the health and well-being of children identified as being held in federal facilities, and saying that this is intended to force the administration's hand in ending what is a moral failing and a human tragedy. And I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's almost no way to justify this kind of thing. And even this morning, Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen did a 180-degree turn, saying that they're going to come up with a new policy that would reunite families.
Maybe she can start going back to Mexican restaurants then. And
well, she was driven out of a Mexican restaurant here in Washington last night, and it was quite unpleasant.
Go ahead, Brent.
So I think that, you know, this is the consequence of what Trump really was talking about when he said he was going to crack down on immigrants. And we were already really tough on immigrants. I think that's what most Americans don't understand. It was already really dire. So these additional steps that Trump is pursuing are horrific in the terms of the inhumanity and, you know, ripping children away from their parents. The primary goal of doing that isn't even that there's a need for it, other than that they think it's a deterrent.
They're abusing children with the hope that other parents won't come.
And in fact, it's not a deterrent, that there are actually more people coming to at least try to apply for a refugee status.
Let me ask Brent about that, because there's reports about that. I just saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal this morning about that. The families who are being interviewed, who are trying to come to a port of entry to seek asylum, are basically saying, we don't have any option. We're in a desperate strait. In other words, asylum is a provision that exists for people who have legitimate fears, legitimate reasons to come across a border. And yet now, in order to even take the next step, Brent, as we understand it, because people are not being allowed through, they try to cross some other way, they're immediately charged with crossing the border illegally, and many of them are just accepting the plea right away, hoping that that will allow them to begin the asylum process. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. You know, and you also don't trigger, if you agree to plea at first, it lessens the severity of the charge. You know, it used to be crossing the border without inspection was akin to a misdemeanor or even less, sometimes an administrative violation. You know, they're now treating it in terms of jailing people like it's a felony, although it's still not a felony. And so yes, they do take the plea because that, you know, it is a lesser charge, and they're able to pursue the asylum claim with a lesser charge on the books, as opposed to, you know, a more serious charge. And yet the thing is that people are coming here because our economy is strong, the unemployment rate's way down, and the conditions in the sending areas, and this isn't really Mexico, we're talking about Central American nations for the most part, those conditions have continued to deteriorate, and it's you either, you know, send them here and risk family separation, or you stay where you are and risk gangs going after your children and then them ending up dead. And I think that's why they're still coming, regardless of the fact that we're treating them so badly.
You know, the president made a very crass statement a couple of days ago that was supposed to be off the record, but he said it in the presence of a whole bunch of people. And it was reported in The Washington Post that most of these kids are going to become MS-13 anyway, he said. And so
Wow. That's
one of the reasons why we need to throw them all out, because they're going to become MS-13 and come here and kill people. And that's the decision that he's made.
Yeah, it's absolutely horrible. The thing is that there's a truth to the fact that these countries are broken, and that there's serious crime, much of it drug-related, much of it gang-driven, and they need our help. They don't need the back of our hand. And the only way they're going to pull out of it is if we step in and do something to help get those countries back on their feet, reestablish law and order in those countries, and create opportunity there. That's the proper way to address this. But this idea that we can use basically a scorched earth policy of mistreating immigrants as harshly as we possibly can, and that will discourage them from coming, it's just, that's not true. It's not going to work. It hasn't worked. And all that ends up happening is that the most powerful nation on the earth is also the most inhumane. And that's not the kind of track record I think most Americans want to pursue.
Let's talk about what a solution might look like. If the decision by the Trump administration is to keep families together by locking everybody up, that may be better in one sense, of course, because the children are with their folks. But on the other hand, they could be being detained wrongly. So it doesn't seem to be, from my point of view, that it's an acceptable solution to just, instead of locking families up, some sort of separated way, to lock them up altogether, even though, of course, that would be demonstrably better.
Well, to be honest with you, we protested the family lockups as well. You know, prison's not a place for a family to stay, regardless of whether, if the alternative is family separation, yes, but that's not the only alternative. The policy before was to release folks and allow them to be present with an authorized status until their court date, at which time the judge would hear their plea for asylum and decide whether to grant it or not. One way to solve this that's more humane, we think, is to speed up those court dates and speed up the hearing so that they can have a quicker resolution to their case. But that means you got to point more money. And Trump hasn't really done that yet to the courts to help the courts with that. A second would be if you don't trust that they're going to return for the court date, then to have some type of, monitoring service beyond that on the parents that would ensure that they show up for the court hearing. So I think there's ways to do this without actually sticking people in prison. But we definitely, under Obama, were protesting the fact that these family detention centers were overfilling. And really, this whole thing was started not because there was a real need for it, but because places like the Heritage Foundation and the Federation for American Immigration Reform were complaining about something called catch and release, which, sounds bad, but in effect, is just a slogan. What they were really talking about is putting families in prison and separating families. And they're getting in their way now, but the rest of the country is horrified by what they really meant.
It's a terrible situation. We're out of time, though. We're joined from Washington by Brent Wilkes. Brent is a leading immigrant rights advocate. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Military officers of the United Arab Emirates are running a system of at least 18 secret prisons across Yemen. Former detainees from those prisons say the Emiratis raped and tortured them in a pattern of sexual violence and abuse that was carried out all across the country. We're joined from Georgia by Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Kathy, we've been hearing for many months now word of atrocities committed by Saudi and Emirati soldiers in Yemen. This is the first time we've heard details of a sexual torture program that's taking place in secret prisons across Yemen. What do you make of this?
Well, I think it's believable. Amnesty International had corroborated an AP report that had come out in 2017, the summer of 2017 in June. And in that report, they talked about ghastly punishments, people being trussed onto rotating spits over open fires, and usage of electronic shock. And so it doesn't come as a surprise, but it's a terrible disappointment in terms of, the just basic belief in the human spirit, to recognize that people would perform sexually abusive torture on people whom they had just encountered. These are apparently the strip searches where they claim that the initial reason for this kind of torture is to make sure that the person they're torturing doesn't have anything in a cavity of their body. But that this goes on then. And you know, we've learned of detention centers run by even more independent groups who pick up refugees who fled from the coast of Africa or further in and inland Africa because they're so desperate for food, and human traffickers bring them over to Yemen and then turn them over to these torture camps. And so it certainly is a gruesome experience that's going on. And even the Congress of the United States, the House of Representatives, had put through a measure that they approved, which said that the defense expenditures that included sale of weapons to the Saudis and the Emiratis ought not go forward until this issue had been investigated. But I don't believe the Senate put through a companion mandate. And so we don't have much strength for investigation coming from the U.S. government. I think it's the court of public opinion that will have to rise up and say, this is intolerable, this kind of human rights violation.
And there has not been any official U.S. government investigation. In fact, a year ago, when these reports first started to trickle out of Yemen, a reporter for the Associated Press asked the Pentagon spokesman what he had heard. And all he said was, the U.S. has seen no evidence of detainee abuse in Yemen. U.S. forces are required to report credible allegations of detainee abuse. We have received no credible allegations. And that's all he said. And that was a year ago, and nobody has addressed it since then. But let me tell you something else that was reported in The Guardian today. It was also reported in Al Jazeera. It says here, 15 officers who arrived at Bir Ahmed prison in Aden hid their faces behind their headdresses, but their accents were clearly identifiable as being from the UAE. They lined up the detainees and ordered them to undress and lie down. The officers then searched the anal cavity of each prisoner, claiming to be looking for a contraband cell phones. The men screamed and wept. Those who resisted were threatened with barking dogs and beaten until they bled, witnesses said. Descriptions of abuse suggest sexual torture is rampant in UAE-controlled prisons in Yemen. So it's not like this is an anomaly. These former detainees are speaking to the press independently of one another, having come from different prisons all around the country.
Well, I do believe we can accept that this is happening. I think we should also ask for investigation about Special Operations Forces mercenaries who've been hired by the UAE to help to train the UAE forces. There's a former United States Special Operations Officer, Steve Tudjman, who has been a bit on the fence. You know, is he working for the United States? Is he working for the United Arab Emirates? And there's also an Australian. His name is Michael Hindemarsh, and he has definitely been taken on board by the United Arab Emirates as their main coordinator of military activities. And so to what extent is the West involved? And also in those earlier stories about torture, there were claims that people had heard the voices of United States individuals while the torture was going on. And again, that wouldn't be new. And, the other thing is our maintenance of Guantanamo greenlighted, I believe, to the rest of the world, the possibility of using torture in prisons to supposedly force interrogations.
Yeah, this is something that we've experienced here in the United States at Abu Ghraib and at Guantanamo. And in the CIA's secret prison system, we learned these techniques from the most despotic regimes through history. And now it appears that our very, very close allies, the United Arab Emirates and probably Saudi Arabia, are doing the exact same thing that we were condemned for doing in the last decade.
Well, and then I'm from Chicago, and I have to mention that the Chicago Police Force was convicted of torturing people who'd been held in horrible situations and subjected to beatings and even the kinds of tactics, hanging people for long periods of time. But I also want to say that the usage of water and food as a weapon of war is essentially another way of torture. I think in previous interviews with you, I've mentioned having been in Iraq and having seen the consequences of the economic sanctions that caused hundreds of thousands of little children to actually be tortured to death. Because when you die of asphyxiation, because you have no food and you can no longer breathe, or your gastrointestinal systems don't work any longer, this is torture. And right now, along with these hideous and ghastly cases that we'll be reading about, we must acknowledge that there are, just in Yemen alone, 8 million people on the brink of starvation, while the United States has not effectively stopped the attack on the port of Hodeidah, which is the main means for importation of food. And while it's possible that street-to-street fighting could happen, this is a scandal. This is something that ought to be condemned, and yet the United States has the gall to walk out of the United Nations Human Rights Commission because of Israel.
Yeah, and because of a defense of an unconscionable defense of Israel. Kathy Kelly is our guest. You know, I think it's really important, John, what Kathy has said about economic sanctions torturing people.
It's all connected.
And, you know, just anecdotally, and this is really minor, but it's just, Kathy, you and I were part of a team, a delegation that went with Ramsey Clark and others to Iraq in May 1998. We brought lots of medicine, several million dollars worth of donated medicine. While I was on the trip, I got a small cut on my foot or something, and it turned into this like huge infection. It ran up my leg. But because our team was bringing medicine, we had medicine. So I was able to take antibiotics. If I hadn't been able to take antibiotics, I probably would have died from that infection because of the way it was happening. That's what Iraqi people were enduring every day, every hour, every minute, and there was no relief. They did not have medicine, and they were deprived of medicine for, you know, more than a decade. And you know, the thing is, it's kind of a quiet, genocidal type approach, and the people from whom these countries, from whom the governments of countries like the United States are issuing sanctions, imposing sanctions, the people in this country don't actually have a clue about what its impact is. Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, I think we have to hope that if people did know, they would care and really try hard to work against the sort of studied indifference that gets peddled by so much of the media that focuses far more on entertainment or on sports or on royalty, as they did just to a disgustingly obsequious extent when Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman toured through the United States. And he was not challenged. Instead, he was feted and aggrandized. But it is significant to me that these stories are getting through to the mainstream media. I actually read about it on Fox News. And so perhaps we have a time when, with concerted effort, consistent refusal to turn away, and most people, once they know, do not want to turn away from this, we might have a chance to educate people to the wider picture of U.S. complicity in the torture of people in Yemen, in the torture of people through commandeering resources desperately needed to constantly go to the military, and in constantly allowing these despots, as you say, militarists, to have the upper hand and to be represented as sort of the salvific fulfillment of what the United States ultimately wants. So that's just not true, and we have to dismantle that.
We have to leave it there. We were joined from Georgia by Kathy Kelly. Kathy is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
National Public Radio, NPR, seems to have a problem with government-related media outlets. This morning, the network ran yet another ridiculous hit piece going after RT and Sputnik. We're joined from Boston by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. Ted, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Ted, one of the things that struck me in this NPR clip, it was 4 minutes from earlier today, was a clip that they played from a Republican campaign advisor going on RT and saying that there was nothing to the Mueller investigation. Now, what this Republican campaign advisor said was absolutely 100% consistent with what he and others have said on Fox News. But somehow, this was anti-American propaganda. How does that work?
Well, apparently, if you say exactly the same thing in other news outlets, or in my case, in my cartoons and in my syndicated columns, as you say on Sputnik or on RT, then it becomes, because RT and Sputnik are financed by the Russian government, those become Russian propaganda. In the same way that if I say those same things on the BBC, which is a British-financed government operation, it becomes English propaganda, and so on.
What if you said it on National Public Radio, though?
Well, I think in that case, it becomes U.S. government-financed propaganda, because the because NPR does receive public funding from, and it does receive funding from, the federal government. So it's, you know, I mean, it's absurd, and it's actually kind of hilarious. The problem is that NPR is taken very seriously by a lot of listeners.
Oh, indeed it is.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of liberal people are going to tune in first to NPR. I mean, I want to just read some of the, well, a little bit of the transcript from this, I would say, disgusting, awful, I don't know, what else? Bad,
absurd.
Really absurd, bizarre programming. But it's in that typical NPR voice. And it says about Radio Sputnik. And they mentioned by any means necessary with Eugene Puryear's show and a guest that they had, Noah Chango, who's also been a guest on our show on Loud and Clear. It says about the networks, these networks often showcase American activists and pundits who parrot Russia's talking points. Now, guess what? Noah Chango is not parroting anybody's talking points. Noah Chango is a formidable, strong political activist in Georgia, in the black community, in the progressive part of politics in the United States. But because she's here on By Any Means Necessary or Loud and Clear, it's a parroting of Russia talking points. Here's another one. The TV network, RT, is part of that country's, meaning Russia's, propaganda machine in the U.S. That is, according to a report from the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the FBI. Now, that's the NPR reporting, as if, okay, let's use U.S. intelligence agencies to denounce political activists who appear on Russian language or English language Russian-sponsored media as parrots. Why? I mean, the whole thing is so disgusting. Go ahead.
It's absurd. I keep saying that, but that's the right word. Who cares what the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI have to say? I mean, these are institutions with a long history of illegality and lying. In fact, lying is part of their job description. It's what they do. So who knows anything that they say? Why would anyone cite them? Why would any news organization, much less an allegedly serious one like NPR, cite these institutions not once but multiple times in the same 4-minute report? And they do. And then Russian talking points. Okay, so I receive Republican and Democratic Party talking points by email every single day. I get them. I know what they are. As far as I know, there are no Russian government talking points, that, at least not that I'm getting. Nobody calls me and says, so this is what the Kremlin thinks, and so please kindly repeat these talking points. And I don't think anyone else is getting them either. It's just, they're just making stuff up. I mean, I hate to say it, to quote a Trumpism, but this is fake news.
Totally. I want to read you something, too, that NPR said about Noah Chango, who Brian said a moment ago, is a regular guest on this show, and she's quite good. It says here, she denounces what she calls racial injustice and oppression. These concerns fall in line with what experts call a key message of Russian propaganda, amplifying existing political and social divisions. Unquote. I don't even know how to react.
Well, this is
how to respond
just like J. Edgar
like
Hoover saying
totally.
Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement were animated, motivated
by communists.
So-called, what she calls racial injustice. Ooh, yeah, she made that term up, racial injustice. And because it also happens to, quote, fall in line with the Russian government. I mean, this is part of what's going on right now, where the narrative in the Russiagate narrative, even denouncing political progressive activists who come on this show or by any means necessary, what they're really doing is not fighting racial injustice or racism or oppression. What they're doing is just being propagandists for Russia. I mean, it's so racist on its face. I mean, what the NPR is doing, it's so denigrating of people who are fighting for peace or progressive causes. And yet it's just treated with a certain kind of normalcy, that NPR voice. You know what I'm talking about, that NPR voice. Like, of course, we can say anything. We can say this rubbish, this racist rubbish, and get away with it because we are the NPR.
Well, yes, all of that. And there's the implication, which they cited some college professor, I forget the guy's name, who is supposedly a Russia expert or expert on Russian media, who said that that people like me are legitimizing RT and Sputnik and Russian propaganda by appearing on these networks. And you know, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking, you know, maybe my invitation to be on NPR got lost in the mail because I don't get invited on NPR. And I don't, you know, the people that they're talking about, like, if they're really so concerned systematically that, that people like me and the woman that you mentioned are like, that we're legitimizing these outlets, then what they should do is co-opt us in the language of the 60s and 70s and have us come on NPR and PBS and major corporate media so that we can talk about the concerns of the working class and issues about racism and sexism and so on, in those mainstream outlets. It's not like any of us would turn them down. We're trying to get the message out to as many people as we possibly can. So it's absurd on its face, and basically the implication, and it's not a very hard one to draw, is that what's legitimate is what's corporate and mainstream and in keeping with U.S. government policy. And those things are legitimate to be discussed in a public forum. And legitimate public forums are only the forums like NPR that are approved by the government and that cite the intelligence community like that report did. But they're basically, activists are supposed to shut up. People who are concerned about racism are supposed to be quiet. We're not supposed to appear anywhere. We're just supposed to shut up and get beaten up by the cops and die sometimes.
And that's exactly what NPR's message was in this piece. It was people like Anoa Chenga and people like Eugene Puryear should just shut their mouths. Sure, there's injustice. Sure, there's police violence against people of color. But you can't say that on a Russian network because they're trying to tear down our democracy.
Yeah. And there's another sort of side to this. I completely agree with both what you said, Ted, and John. You know, I've been on National Public Radio multiple times. I've been interviewed. So I have the same message when I'm on National Public Radio as I would have here on Radio Sputnik. So why would it be okay for National Public Radio to interview me if really all I'm doing is, quote, parroting Russian propaganda or parroting some other propaganda? I was on NPR because I was leading anti-war demonstrations, and they would sometimes, rarely, I have the anti-war movement on. Same with CNN, same with MSNBC, same with Fox. But Ted is right. In general, in the last 10 years, and certainly in the last 5 years, those platforms have been basically shut off to people who are progressive, independent, grassroots political activists, even though it was a little bit more open once upon a time.
It was actually a little better before Obama, believe it or not. I feel like when George W. Bush left office is when the deep freeze, especially on outlets like MSNBC, occurred. I used to appear quite regularly on Fox. And there were and MSNBC certainly quite often, and CNN. The freeze has been on. There are occasions where the people cited in the NPR report are, occasionally allowed to appear in these mainstream pro-government corporate outlets, but it's few and far between.
It is few. And you're totally right, Ted. During the last 5 years or even 8 years, it's been far worse than it was in the first decade of the millennium.
Absolutely right.
What liberals have to sort of come to grips with, the liberals who are supporting the Russiagate narrative, is that it is being used to shut down the left. And so if the left, this term will soon have no meaning if it doesn't already, if what the left means in the United States in terms of voices that are heard is the Democratic Party, that means in essence there would be no left, because the Democratic Party is not left. It's a right-center party. And there's a fine line between this right-center party and the just slightly further to the right party, the Republican Party. It is a very, very fine line.
With that said, we are totally out of time. We were joined from Boston, Massachusetts by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Former CIA Director John Brennan told MSNBC yesterday that he was alarmed by reports that the Trump administration has carried out 5 times the number of drone attacks around the world than the Obama administration carried out. Brennan claimed that the Obama drone program killed almost no civilians at all, and that the Trump program must be killing civilians due to the sheer volume of the bombings. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She's an activist and professor of anthropology at Stockton University. And we're joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kazi, let's start with you. I remember seeing reputable numbers, UN-related, NGO-related, on the ground in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen, saying that the number of civilian deaths from drones during the Obama administration, the numbers were something like 50 to 70%. What do you make of John Brennan's comments that there were almost no civilian deaths?
So I think one of the things we have to be really attentive to is the kind of laughable manner in which civilian deaths were tallied under the Obama administration's drone warfare program. And one of the most Islamophobic elements of the Obama administration in terms of its counterterrorism efforts was the fact that adult Muslim men were tallied as enemy combatants in the drone warfare program, meaning that just by virtue of this belonging to this demographic group, they were counted not as civilians, but as enemy combatants, unless proven otherwise. So this really made it difficult for people to get a good sense of how many civilians the Obama administration did kill in its drone warfare program. And a lot of that fell on, you know, watchdog groups and investigative journalists to find out the real numbers. So I think that's a really important thing for us to be thoughtful of, is that we don't actually have an accurate measure of just how many civilians were killed under both Obama's drone warfare program and Trump's new instantiation of it. I think it is laughable for John Brennan to say that Obama's warfare program with drones was so surgical and precise, when we know that drones themselves as a technology are a big question mark. I mean, you hear drone operators remarking on just how pixelated and grainy the images they have are of these surgical strikes themselves. And so you see that, you know, what we understand from official government reports is likely, you know, deeply inaccurate.
Margaret, I'm looking at a document from, or it's actually a story about a document, and it's from 2 years ago in the Huffington Post. The headline is, nearly 90% of people killed in recent drone strikes were not the target. U.S. drone strikes have killed scores of civilians in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And then the report says, documents detailing a special operations campaign in northeastern Afghanistan, Operation Haymarket, show that between January 2012 and February 2013, U.S. special operation airstrikes killed more than 200 people. Of those, only 35 were the intended targets. Those are pretty remarkable numbers, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if the majority of people killed. And let's face it, all the people killed are being killed illegally. These are targeted assassinations.
They are. And before you answer that question, let me add something, too. I can't tell you how many times over the years when we were looking for Osama bin Laden, we would bomb a wedding, for example, because there was a tall man wearing white. And just in case it was Osama bin Laden, we bombed it. We would kill dozens of people. It wasn't Osama bin Laden. As a policy, we never apologize for things like that. And then through the Afghan government, we would very quietly give the survivors millions of dollars to keep their mouth shut. Well, those killings are counted as successful drone attacks against terrorists because at the time we thought disingenuously that they were terrorists. To the point that Dr. Nazia Kazi made, the Pentagon's internal rule is if you are 14 years old and male in the Middle East, you're an enemy combatant. And so they can kill you. They don't know anything else about you. They can kill you. And that is counted as a legitimate drone strike.
Go ahead, Margaret.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, let's look at what exactly is going on and break through some of these lies that people are being told. Even the terms that are being used are completely false and misleading. Signature strikes, surgical strikes. What we're looking at is extrajudicial killings. People are determined to be targets without any formal process, without even knowledge that they're being targeted. And then we know that these, you know, the so-called signature strike, where they just look at the behavior of a person or groups and decide that that is suspicious, and so they can kill them. And then the missiles that they're using, these Hellfire missiles, there's nothing precision about these missiles. They can kill people within a distance from where they hit of, you know, the length of a football field. And they do such destruction that it's hard to even tell how many people were killed in that strike. So we don't have good numbers, but we do have, you know, if you look at the drone papers that were put out a number of years ago, they looked at just a few kind of examples. In Pakistan, they were targeting 24 people. They had a list of 24 people. And in their attempts to go after those 24 people, they killed 874 people. 142 of them were children. That was what they determined. So this is completely illegal. It is disgusting. It is shameful that we as people in the United States are accepting this type of behavior and knowing that at best we're not getting the people that we think we should be targeting, but we're also creating a lot of animosity and insecurity for people in the United States and around the world.
That's the voice of Dr. Margaret Flower. She's co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out their work at popularresistance.org. We're also joined by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She is an activist and professor of anthropology at Stockton University. We're talking to her from Philadelphia. Dr. Kazi, what other country in the world has its chief executive sit with his or her military advisors every week and draw up a kill list and then send out drones and have their operators then target these people for assassination? When Obama left office, I don't know what it's like under Trump. It's probably intensified. The U.S. was droning 7 countries, I believe, in that last week. But there was that meeting we all heard about, that every Tuesday or something like that, President Obama set with his advisors to go over a kill list to decide who would be killed. Is there any other government that does this?
I mean, I think your question is an important one, because what we're seeing is this wholesale expansion, exponential expansion of executive powers in the U.S. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's important when we talk about Trump to understand him not as some kind of freakish outlier to the American political system, but as kind of the inevitable next step in what has been going on for quite some time. And when we're talking about these so-called surgical strikes, we can see their seedlings sort of under Clinton and Bush, and then they really take off under Obama, you know? And I think we have to look very critically at the AUMF passed within weeks, I believe, of September 11, 2001, which really transformed wholesale the nature of executive power and the president's relationship to warfare, and really giving a president the right to fight a perpetual war without calling it a perpetual war. I mean, the ability to go after individuals, to go after countries themselves without any congressional approval. And what we see here then is just this really terrifying expansion of executive power that is not, we can't pin that squarely on Trump. I mean, he's, you know, running amok with it, but there's a deeper, a much deeper continuity there. And so, you know, what we're seeing with the drone warfare program is a transformation of what modern warfare and modern imperialism really looks like. I mean, the fact that we're able to, you know, take out these numbers of civilians without having any more boots on the ground actually changes the whole politics of anti-war resistance back here at home. You know, I mean, it seems that we have less of a dog in the fight when we're not seeing these flag-draped coffins coming home, you know, and we're also having to think about the new kind of trauma that is experienced by these people who are basically playing video games and carrying out these pixelated killings. You know, so it is a really striking and troubling transformation of how warfare works.
I couldn't agree more. That was Dr. Nazia Kazi. We have 2 minutes left. Margaret Flowers, that's right. I mean, Dr. Kazi is right. It transforms the nature of war where you can sort of guarantee to your own home population, look, hey, everybody, all the bleeding, all the dying, all the suffering is going to be over there. You don't even have to know about it. And that makes the decisions so much easier because you can kind of assume that there won't be a vast anti-war opposition. This was John Brennan. He was Obama's CIA director, so in charge of these programs. And now he's, guess what, a commentator on the liberal MSNBC explaining to the population, oh, it's so bad under Trump, but when we did it, we were clean, no collateral damage. So it's not just a military-industrial complex. It's the military-industrial mainstream media complex where all of these same people, including the CIA director, are now our TV at-home pundits. Anyway, 1 minute left, Margaret.
Well, I just wanted to quickly add the element of racism as well, because what are the countries that we're involved in doing these drone strikes? You know, countries in Africa like Somalia or in the Middle East. These are countries where we're bombing and killing people, of, you know, black and brown people. And we don't hear an outcry in the United States about the deaths of these people. And so we have to ask ourselves, you know, what else is playing into our acceptance of this type of behavior? Is it our own kind of, you know, white supremacy that allows us to ignore what we're doing? So I think it's really important for people to think about these issues and to recognize that we have to stop the killing. It's infecting, you know, it's a problem around the world, but if you're not thinking outside of the borders, it's also hurting us here in the United States as well. So we really need to revive that peace movement.
That's the voice of Dr. Margaret Flowers, who joined us from Baltimore. She is the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance, and you can check out their work at popularresistance.org. And we were also joined from Philadelphia by Dr. Nazia Kazi. She's an activist and professor of anthropology at Stockton University. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Violence continued across Nicaragua today, a day after the collapse of talks between President Daniel Ortega and the opposition. More than 180 people have been killed in violence that started when the IMF demanded that the government cut pensions and impose economic austerity. We're joined from Nicaragua by Nils McCune. He's a political analyst and journalist. Nils, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Nils, this really is not covered very widely here in the U.S. press. And to tell you the truth, I was shocked at how many people have died since the start of this. Can you tell us exactly why this is happening and where the violence is?
Sure. I remember last time we talked about the Social Security reform and that the protests had taken on a life of their own. Well, unfortunately, all of that has intensified measurably. So the Social Security reform was rescinded by President Ortega upon seeing the protests to create a better environment for a national dialogue. And in the time between when he called for a national dialogue and when that dialogue sat down to speak with between the government and opposition leaders, including private sector students who had protested and the Nicaraguan NGO sector, in that span, which took about a month, there were up to 60 more deaths. Most of these deaths have been gunshot wounds. Most of the victims have been men. and almost all of the wounds have been to the head or neck. So it's a very conspicuous sort of violence. It's not the kind that you would assume that a beleaguered police force that's trying to handle riots would be able to accomplish. The violence took place across the country to begin with, and there's been various hotspots that have formed. Messiah has been the main hotspot of the last 3 weeks. In Messiah, the way this works, the script for the violence is that there's some sort of a protest that is able to achieve some sort of an engagement, a confrontation, film it, decontextualize it, and then make it go viral on social media and put some sort of a very strong claim to it. Usually the claim is massacre. So what we've heard in the international and the national press is that the government is massacring people. The reality is quite different because really we have a certain level of legitimate opposition to the government, mostly traditional right-wing parties, but also some students that have sort of a social democrat perspective and they would like to sort of have a revolution of their own that has been fostered and supported materially by the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, the private sector organization called COSEP, which is like the umbrella group for the private sector, and unfortunately also by organized crime. So it's a great breakout moment for narcotráfico, for organized crime here in Nicaragua, because it's the one country of Central America where the drug trade has never been substantial. So because of the ongoing protests and under the cover of sort of political violence, narco-trafficking has been able to make significant inroads all across the country. And they have been, much of who has been paying the people to hold up these barricades across the country. So the barricades basically block traffic, prevent people from going to work. Across the country, many, many people haven't been able to go to work. There's been an estimate over a month ago that 58,000 people had lost their jobs. By now, I would say it's far over 100,000 people who have lost their jobs. Based on the inability for people to move and get to work. Obviously, farmers haven't been able to plant their farms. This is the beginning of the growing season, or sell their products. And so this sense of crisis, an immediate crisis, has really debilitated the negotiation process. There is a national dialogue in place where the government has committed to put any topic on the table. And the topic that the opposition has put on the table is the immediate resignation of Daniel Ortega. There is also a process to advance the elections, which could happen next year with the oversight of the Organization of American States. But of course, that would require some constitutional steps to be able to have a transparent electoral process that can be given the green light by all parties. But there is a sector of the opposition which is opposed to having this negotiation take place, which is opposed to having elections, and which would rather have a coup d'etat, an immediate resignation of Daniel Ortega, and the assumption of government by some sort of unelected body, which we don't know who would decide.
Nils McEwen is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m., if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, at two radio stations, 105.5 FM and at 1390 AM. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can subscribe to this show as an iTunes podcast or at iHeartRadio. Nils, this is, I would say, pretty confusing to people who are trying to follow it, including progressive people in the United States. And I want to help try to unravel some of this. And you've already done a very excellent job in terms of creating some context here. But here's my question to you. Try to characterize the Ortega government. It seems to me that we had the IMF doing what the IMF regularly does in developing or third world countries, which is to try to impose austerity. You have a progressive government that was born out of a revolutionary process, the Sandinista Revolution, but which is still operating within the framework of the world capitalist economy, which is dominated by a neoliberal rules, essentially. Nicaragua isn't able to dictate its own terms. The terms are dictated to it. So within this playing field where there is not many enviable options, Ortega tried to resist some of the austerity measures on Social Security, unable to resist all austerity measures because the country is cash-strapped. And then there's this kind of cross-class and multi-tendencied opposition, which really seeks only one thing, which is to overthrow the current government and create a new government for a myriad set of different political agendas that are momentarily intersecting. So it seems like a recipe for classic economic destabilization. We saw that in Chile between 1970 and 73. We saw that in Iran in 1951, 52, 53. These were the precursors for a Western-backed or a U.S.-British-backed coup d'etat. And then the reclaiming of those countries after the fact as part of an American sphere of influence. Are you seeing it somewhat in that kind of classic destabilization mode?
Sure. I think the clearest example is to compare the photographs of protests in Venezuela, what are called Guarimba protests, with the protests in Nicaragua. They're carbon copy. It's the exact same images of a young protester wrapped up in the flag, putting a flower on a group of anti-riot police. It's the exact same thing. It's young people burning down government buildings. And there's a very strong component of fake news to make all of this work. So you'll get a clip of police arresting someone, but you won't see that these people had just set fire to a cop car or et cetera, et cetera. The Nicaraguan government is best characterized sort of as a populist, reformist, progressive government that has come out of a process of national reconciliation. There was certainly a true revolutionary process here in Nicaragua, which was defeated through a combination of U.S. intervention and exhaustion from war. And so during the 1990s, we had neoliberal governments here that robbed, they pillaged the government itself and the social security system. And so you have the return of Daniel Ortega in 2007 with a progressive agenda, but also with the need to engage some of the historical enemies of the Sandinista revolution. And those include the Catholic hierarchy and the business sector. So what Daniel Ortega created was a negotiated consensus sort of government where there's a continual negotiation taking place between labor unions, the business sector, and the government. And at various times, there have been interventions and dialogue with the Catholic Church. So that's the framework for trying to follow through with basically the IMF vision of what a responsible government looks like, but also producing very significant redistribution programs, especially with regard to health, housing, and work, which have allowed Nicaragua to really leave behind its worst period of poverty. So the country was considered by many to be in its best position in history just 3 months ago. The poverty rate had fallen tremendously. There's free health care, free and high quality education through university. It's really interesting for the second poorest country in the Americas to be able to produce this level of standard.
It's pretty good. Education, medical care.
It was good. I mean, but here, this is the thing. I mean, here's a country doing the best it can with very, very limited resources and adopting some neoliberal policies, hoping that it would appease its enemies.
And it results in violence.
Yeah, and it results in an escalation, a destabilization campaign.
The message is that there can be no progressive government from Texas to Chile. There can be no progressive government that will not be allowed.
I could see that, yeah. Well, we're out of time. We were joined from Nicaragua by Nils McCune. He's a political analyst and journalist. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.